This presentation has been previously broadcast.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
This is hour two of the Patrick Madrid Show. I'm so happy you're with me. Thank you for listening. The number is 888-914-9149. So we were talking about hell, and I know it's not a particularly pleasant topic, but from time to time it's important to think about it, because after all, Jesus thought it was important enough to warn about it repeatedly in the Gospels. As you read through the four Gospels, you will see Jesus repeatedly telling people about hell. So I'm not here to be doom and gloom or anything, but if it's good enough for Jesus to bring it up as often as he did, I figure we can talk about it once in a while on this program too, don't you think? So I shared with you the story of a guy in England who said that he saw hell. He was there for 23 minutes, and he gave an account that's very vivid. And also, in some respects, it's very similar to what others have said about what they have seen in instances where they were shown hell, including, as I mentioned, Sister Lucia, the oldest of the three children in Fatima, to whom Our Lady appeared in 1917. And many years later, as she was writing her memoirs, Sister Lucia wrote about the vision of hell that the Blessed Virgin Mary gave to these three children. And I know that everything about this is counterintuitive, because you may say, well, gosh, little kids, I mean, they don't need to know about that. We shouldn't be talking about sin. Well, Our Lady felt it was important enough to show these three children hell. So I personally think that we can take a cue from that, and not that we're trying to scare people or we're not trying to be morose or anything like that, but if it's good enough for Jesus to talk about it as often as he did, if it's good enough for the Blessed Virgin Mary to show these three shepherd children hell, shouldn't that be a cue to us that maybe we should pay more attention to it? The four last things: death, judgment, heaven, and hell. So it's in that spirit that I want to kind of bounce off the comments that that guy made, things that he saw. And I don't know whether he really saw hell. Who knows what it was? But I do believe that St. Teresa of Avila saw hell. And so in her memoirs, she talks about how, as I was mentioning before the break, she was living a rather lukewarm life. She took up the habit of reading romance novels. Now, the romance novels of, like, you know, the 1600s, I'm sure were, as by comparison to what is available nowadays, probably as pure as the wind driven snow. But for her, they were an occasion of sin. And she also lived a life, she went into religious life, but it was a very kind of lax sort of convent life. This is why she became such a powerful reformer, because the way the religious sisters were living in the convent, you had those who were wealthy and they had all sorts of guests and they had specially embroidered religious habits, and they had nice food and dainty things. And so there was a lot of laxity, I'll put it that way. So in her memoir, she talks about how she got very sick, and she appeared to all the people in her family, everybody who was there, she appeared to have died. They couldn't detect a heartbeat. There was no breath. You know, you could hold a mirror up to her nose and mouth and it wouldn't fog up because there was no breath. And she lied there motionless for a few days, and they were preparing to bury her. And it was during this time, when she appeared to be dead, that she had an out-of-body experience. And this is what she said about that. She said, "I found myself, as I thought, plunged right into hell. I realized that it was the Lord's will that I should see the place which the devils had prepared for me there, and which I had merited for my sins. This happened in the briefest space of time, but even if I were to live for many years, I believe it would be impossible for me to forget it. The entrance, I thought, resembled a very long, narrow passage, like a furnace, very low, dark, and closely confined. The ground seemed to be full of water, which looked like filthy, evil-smelling mud, and in it were many wicked-looking reptiles, at the end of which there was a hollow place scooped out of a wall like a cupboard, and it was here that I found myself in close confinement. But the sight of all this was pleasant by comparison with what I felt there. My feelings, I think, could not possibly be exaggerated, nor can anyone understand them. I felt a fire within my soul, the nature of which I am utterly incapable of describing. I had been put in this place, which looked like a hole in the wall, and those very walls, so terrible to the sight, bore down upon me and completely stifled me. There was no light and everything was in the blackest darkness. She said, "This vision was one of the most signal favors which the Lord has bestowed upon me. It has been of the greatest benefit to me, both in taking from me all fear of the tribulations and disappointments of this life, and also in strengthening me to suffer them and to give thanks to the Lord, who, as I now believe, has delivered me from such terrible and never-ending torments." She says, "It also inspired me with fervent impulses for the good of souls, for I really believe that to deliver a single one of them from such dreadful tortures, I would willingly die many deaths. After all, if we see anyone on earth who is especially dear to us suffering great trial or pain, our very nature seems to move us to compassion. And if his sufferings are as severe, they oppress us too." So there's a snippet from what she had to say. Now, you may wonder what happened to her. Well, she came out of whatever this trance was that she was in. And lucky for her, because they would have buried her if it had gone on for another day or so. But she had a radical transformation. She was no longer tepid and lukewarm. She was no longer prone to some of the sins that she was dabbling in, none of which seemed to be, say, of the sixth and the ninth commandment variety. But they were enough to send her to hell. So now let's listen to what St. John Bosco had to say. He had a prophetic dream of hell, and St. John Bosco was interesting. He lived, and he was really at his heyday in Italy around the time of the American Civil War, around the time of Abraham Lincoln. That's when he seemed to be at the peak of his, of his prodigious dreams and prophecies and things. And among the gifts that God gave to St. John Bosco was he would show him in visions that took place in dreams things that would happen in the future that did happen. So he could predict things that would take place. So in this dream, he's explaining what he saw when it came to being shown hell. And it's somewhat lengthy, but it's very interesting, and I'd like you to think about this. So this took place, he says, on Sunday night, May the 3rd, 1868. He said, "I have a dream to tell you, a sort of aftermath of those I told you last week, which totally exhausted me." He said, on this particular night, a frightful toad seemed bent on devouring me. When it finally vanished, a voice said to me, "Why don't you tell them?" I turned in that direction and saw a distinguished person standing by my bed. Feeling guilty about my silence, I asked, "What should I tell my boys?" And by the way, he ran a school for largely poor young men who didn't have the opportunity to go to school. Their families were poor. So he had them live in this oratory, and he and the other teachers and things would teach them how to do craftsmanship, woodworking, all of the things that could get them jobs when they got older. They had mass every day, and they could learn how to read and write. So those are the boys he's talking about. He says, "So what should I tell my boys?" And this personage who appears to be an angel says, "What have you seen and heard in your last dreams, and what you have wanted to know, and what shall be revealed to you?" And then he vanished. So here's what happened next. He says, when the dream resumed, he was told, "Get up and follow me." "For heaven's sake," he protested, "leave me alone. I'm exhausted. I've been tormented by a toothache for several days now. I need rest. Besides, these nightmares have completely worn me out." And the man, who appears to have been an angel, said, "Get up. You have no time to lose. Where are you taking me?" "Never mind, you'll see." He led me to a vast, boundless plain, veritably a lifeless desert, with not a soul in sight or a tree or a brook. Yellowed, dried-up vegetation added to the desolation. I had no idea where I was or what I was to do. For a moment, I even lost sight of my guide and feared I was alone and lost. Then he said he finally saw his friend coming to him, and he said, I asked him, "Where am I?" "Come with me and you'll find out." "All right, I'll go with you." He led the way, and I followed in silence, but after a long, dismal trudge, I began to worry whether I should ever be able to cross that vast expanse. Suddenly, I saw a road ahead. "Where are we going to now?" I asked my guide. He says, "This way." We took the road. Now, listen to this description. Fascinating. We took the road. It was beautiful, wide, and neatly paved. Both sides were lined with magnificent, verdant hedges dotted with gorgeous flowers. Roses especially peeped everywhere through the leaves. At first glance, the road was level and comfortable, and so I ventured upon it without the least suspicion. But soon I noticed that it insensibly kept sloping downward. Although it did not look steep at all, I found myself moving so swiftly that I felt I was effortlessly gliding through the air. Really, I was gliding and hardly using my feet. Then the thought struck me that the return trip would be very long and arduous. In other words, you got to go back up that hill. And by the way, that road that he was on, Jesus talked about that. The road is wide and well-traveled. It leads to perdition. So he says to the angel, how are we going to get back to the oratory? And the angel says, don't worry. God Almighty wants you to go. He who leads you on will also lead you back. So St. John Bosco says, the road is sloping downward. As we were continuing on our way, flanked by banks of roses and other flowers, I became aware that the oratory boys and very many others whom I did not know were following me. Somehow, I found myself in their midst. As I was looking at them, I noticed now one, now another, fall to the ground and instantly be dragged by an unseen force toward a frightful drop, distantly visible, which sloped into a furnace. What makes these boys fall? I asked my companion. The proud have hidden a net for me, and they have stretched out cords for a snare. They have laid for me a stumbling block by the wayside. That's a quote from Psalm 139. So the angel says, take a closer look. I did. Traps were everywhere, some close to the ground, others at eye level, but all well concealed. Unaware of their danger, many boys got caught and they tripped. They would sprawl to the ground, legs in the air. Then when they managed to get back on their feet, they would run headlong down the road toward the abyss. Some got trapped by the head, others by the neck, hand, arms, legs, or sides, and were pulled down instantly. The ground traps, fine as spiders' webs, were visible, barely visible, seemed very flimsy and harmless, yet to my surprise, every boy they snared fell to the ground. Noticing my astonishment, the angel remarked, do you know what this is? Some filmy fiber, I answered. A mere nothing, he said, just plain human respect. Seeing that many boys were being caught in those traps, I asked, why do they get caught? Why do so many get caught? Who pulls them down? He says, go nearer and you will see. So I followed his advice and I didn't see anything peculiar. Look closer, he said. I picked up one of the traps and tugged. I immediately felt some resistance. I pulled harder, only to feel that instead of drawing the thread closer, I was being pulled down myself. I did not resist and soon found myself at the mouth of a frightful cave. I halted, unwilling to venture into that deep cavern, and again started pulling the thread toward me. It gave a little, but only through great effort on my part. I kept tugging, and after a long while, a huge, hideous monster emerged, clutching a rope to which all those traps were tied together. He was the one who instantly dragged down anyone who got caught in them. It won't do to match my strength with his, I said to myself. I'll certainly lose. I had better fight him with the sign of the cross in prayer. So then he asks his guide, you know, who is this? He says, now you know, it's the devil. St. John Bosco says, carefully examining many of the traps, I saw that each one bore an inscription, pride, disobedience, envy, the sixth commandment, theft, gluttony, sloth, anger, and so on. Stepping back a bit to see which ones trapped the greater number of boys, I discovered that the most dangerous were those of impurity, disobedience, and pride. In fact, these three were linked together. Many other traps also did great harm, but not as much as the first two. Still watching, I noticed many boys running faster than others. Why such haste, I asked? Because they are dragged by the snare of human respect. Looking more closely, I spotted knives among the traps. The providential hand had put them there for cutting oneself free. The bigger ones, symbolizing meditation and prayer, were used against the trap of pride. Others, not quite as big, symbolized spiritual reading. There were also two swords, representing devotion to the Blessed Sacrament, especially through frequent communion and to the Blessed Virgin. There was also a hammer symbolizing confession, and other knives signifying devotion to St. Joseph and to the other saints. By these means, quite a few boys were able to free themselves or evade capture. Indeed, I saw some lads walking safely through all those traps, either by good timing before the trap sprung on them, or by making it slip off after they got caught. When my guide was satisfied I had observed everything, he made me continue along that rose-hedged road, but the further we went, the scarcer the roses became. Long thorns began to show up, and soon the roses were no more. The hedges became sun-scorched, leafless, and thorn-studded. Withered branches torn from the bushes lay crisscrossed across the roadbed, littering it with thorns and making it impassable. We had come now to a gulch, whose steep sides hid what lay beyond. The road, still sloping downward, was becoming ever more horrid, rutted, guttered, and bristling with rocks and boulders. I lost track of all my boys, most of whom had left this treacherous road for other paths. I kept going, but the farther I advanced, the more arduous and steep became the descent, so that I tumbled and fell several times and lied prostrate on the ground until I could catch my breath. Now and then my guide supported me or helped me to rise. At every step, my joints seemed to give way, and I thought my shin bones would snap. Panting, I said to my guide, "My legs won't carry me another step. I can't go any farther." He did not answer, but continued walking. So I followed, and he, seeing me soaked in perspiration and thoroughly exhausted, led me to a little clearing alongside the road, where I sat down and took a deep breath, and I felt a little better. And from my resting place, I could see that the road continued to be very steep and jagged, strewn with loose stones. But what lay ahead seemed so much worse that I closed my eyes in horror. And he asked, "Can I go back?" And the angel says, "No." So then he comes to the outskirts of hell. What has been happening all along is, you might say, a metaphor for this life, where it's everything seems great. You know, roses, and it's smooth traveling, it's easy. And the more it goes, the more you realize, you know, this is the road to hell. So he finally gets there. He says, "We got to the very end of the road, and at the bottom of this road, there was a dark valley, and an enormous building loomed into sight, its towering portal tightly locked facing our road. When I finally got to the bottom, I became smothered by a suffocating heat, while a greasy, green-tinted smoke lit by flashes of scarlet flames rose from behind these enormous walls that loomed larger than mountains. 'What is this? Where are we?' I said. And the angel said, 'Read the inscription on the portal.' He says, I looked up and read these words, 'The place of no reprieve.' I realized that we were at the gates of hell. The guide led me around this horrible place. At first, the bronze doors that overlooked this area looked normal, but I came closer and I said, and he read the words of Jesus inscribed here, 'Depart from me, ye cursed, into everlasting fire, which was prepared for the devil and his angels.'" That's Matthew 25:41. And also the words of Jesus in Matthew 7:19, "Every tree that yields not good fruit will be cut down and will be cast into the fire." He says, he stood there in terror and noticed a young man racing down the path at an uncontrollable speed. He says, "I kept my eyes on him, trying to identify him. And as he got closer, I recognized him as one of my boys. His disheveled hair was partly standing upright on his head. His arms were outstretched as though he were thrashing the water in an attempt to stay afloat. He wanted to stop, but he couldn't stop. Tripping on the protruding stones, he kept falling ever faster. 'Let's help him,' I said. 'Let's stop him.' And the guide said, 'Leave him alone.' And he says, 'Why?' He said, 'Don't you know how terrible God's vengeance is? Do you think you can restrain one who is fleeing from his just wrath?'" And here's the ending. He says, "The boy crashed into the bronze door. It sprang open with a roar, and instantly a thousand inner doors opened with a deafening clamor as if struck by a body that had been propelled by an invisible, irresistible gale. As these bronze doors, one behind the other, and at considerable distance from each other, remained momentarily open, I saw far into the distance something like a furnace with fire, and I saw the moment that that youth hurtled into it. As swiftly as they had opened, the portals then clanged shut, and he said, 'I want out of here.'" So there you have an extended description from St. John Bosco, who was known for receiving this kind of heavenly information, and he found it important enough to share with his boys, and this has been printed in books about his life and whatnot. This is just one of many of these kinds of dreams that he had. So here again, I'm not here to be Mr. Wet Blanket. I'm not here to, you know, to scare anybody unnecessarily, although the Bible does say that fear of God is the beginning of wisdom, right? So it's worth your time and mind every so often just to take stock of this reality. And as St. John Bosco was saying, to recognize that there are traps along the way that can be very subtle and seemingly very nice and very, very good to the, and they appeal to us. But in fact, they can be traps that will lead us downward. There you have it. This is the perfect time to take a break, and then we'll go on to other matters, including your phone calls. The number to dial is 888-914-9149. I'll be right back with more right after this. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
I love my job. What can I tell you? Monday through Friday, I get to hang out with you, and I thank you for that. The number is 888-914-9149. Back to the phone, Shirley in New Mexico. It's good to have you on the program. Welcome.
Okay, is that me? I didn't hear my
name. That's you. Shirley.
Okay. Hi. How are you, Patrick?
Doing
I know
well,
I'm
thanks.
Not supposed to ask. But anyhow, I have this question on the Bible. My parents gave me their Bible, and my dad passed away. It's going to be 3 years in September. And my Bible, I got that one when my husband and I got married. And I was going through my parents' Bible because they gave it to me when my dad passed away. And I was just going through it, you know, and I went through this page where it says the book of Josué, and my dad's name is Josué. And I thought, what? I've never seen this in my whole entire life. And I've had different Bibles, smaller ones with bigger letters now that I'm older. But anyhow, it's always said the book of Joshua. And, you know, I got all these, you know, chills and like in a happy chill, you know, when I saw this book of Josué, and I thought, what is the difference? Why does this one say Josué? You know, and
is that a Bible in English or Spanish?
They're English. Yes, it's English. That's
okay.
What's confusing me too,
to
because okay,
I can explain it to you. Okay, so what took place was the if you look at a Douay Rheims version of the Bible, you'll notice that a number of names are spelled differently. So, like now, we say Noah, N-O-A-H, is how it's spelled in the Bible now. But in those days, it was Noah, so it'd be N-O-E. And the same is true with a number of other names. And so what you have there is an older version of the Bible. This is why I asked you if it was in Spanish, because Josué would be the Spanish version of Joshua. So what you have there is just a more archaic version of Scripture. Nothing wrong with it. I'm not suggesting otherwise. But you're seeing there some of the older way of spelling these names as opposed to what you're used to seeing now. You see?
Well, whatever way it happens, I love seeing my dad's name there. You know, and I pay masses for him, and there for a while they were pronouncing his name Jose. And so I had to, you know, go and talk to the lectors and the priest that my dad's name is Josué, you know, like when you sway to the side. And so now they pronounce his name right, Josué. And so anyway, it was just a really good, loving feeling to see my dad's name in the Bible, you know. Okay. And I went quickly to the other Bible and I thought, well, wait a minute. It's just on this Bible. So anyway.
That's what it is. That's what it is. I can imagine how that brings you some joy to see your father's name there. I'm glad you called today. Thank you, Shirley. Let's go now to Marjorie in Maywood, New Jersey. Hi, Marjorie.
Maywood.
Yeah.
Hi. Can you hear? I hope I can hear
I can
you.
Hear
I just
you.
Turned my speaker up.
Okay.
I just thought it was fascinating that you went to a talk about hell, which was great, by the way, after talking about Saul Alinsky, who, you know, which people mostly don't know. But when Barack Obama made his wonderful speech to the DNC, my husband and I were very impressed. And my husband said, I know nothing about this guy. So we did some research and we read some books like The Culture of Corruption by Michelle Malkin and Jerome Corsi's The Abomination, and found out that Obama had communist parents and grandparents, a communist mentor in college. Mm-hmm. He was also with... his two fathers. Mm-hmm. Yeah, his two fathers were Islamic. And he spent his childhood in Indonesia and was put as a Muslim.
I'm very familiar with all those points. So what about that, Marjorie?
Oh, okay. I just was wondering, you I guess we were saying that Zelensky was spreading the seeds of this radical movement, which is just I think, destroying our country now. And I just want people to know that Barack Obama was one of his chief sowers. Mm-hmm. And it's just very frightening. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know what we can do about it at this point, because it's gone through the whole government and school system and all the evils that are happening today. It's been in the works for years.
But you know what, though? I don't disagree with many of the points you're making there. And things that have happened by God's permission. Let's not forget that. God permitted this to happen. So it's part of his providence. And I think we should always step back and see things in light of God's providence. Meaning, as Jesus said, in the world you will have tribulation, but be of good cheer, for I have overcome the world. So rather than, I hope that you don't feel discouraged or forlorn about this. Yes, the problems really do exist. There's no doubt about that. But greater is he who is in us than he who is in the world. So this is a great time, don't you think, Marjorie, for us to be Catholic? It's a great time for us to be in the midst of these problems so that we can be part of the solution. I find it very energizing, personally. I don't find it the least bit discouraging. I find it very encouraging. Well, I really do. And here's why. I'll just repeat myself for effect. God wants you and me and everybody listening to the sound of my voice right now and everybody else, he wants us here now for a reason. We're not here by happenstance. We're here for a reason. We have a role to play. And so especially in the midst of turmoil and strife, I mean, I don't like turmoil and strife. I know you don't. I'd like to walk the other way. But if it's God's will that we live at a time and in a place where these problems are here, it's because he wants us to do something about it. So I find that very exciting, personally. Very energizing. You know, what does Jesus say? Pray, 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 pray. We're called to be a light in the darkness. So maybe for you, it's not necessarily a national radio audience. That's not true for most people, obviously. But you can influence your circle of friends. You can be a light shining the truth. You can speak the truth in love in a person-specific way. So we can all do that. And I'm sure you do. In your own way, I'm sure you already do that. Thanks, Marjorie. God bless you. Hang in there. It's going to be okay. Let's go to James now in Santa Cruz, California. Beautiful area. Hi, James.
Hey, Patrick. I have a question that's been kind of weighing on me, and I just want to... I'm a little confused on the mark of the beast and children.
Okay.
Like where everybody will have to take the mark and all that, but aren't children innocent? And whoever takes the mark will be damned. If I'm correct. I'm confused on the children. Doesn't mean aren't they innocent? So where do they stand?
So let's look at that. So we see the mark of the beast described to us in Revelation chapter 13, chapter 14, chapter 16, chapter 19. So it's also again in chapter 20. So it's clearly a recurring theme in the book of Revelation as a sign of this persecution of the Antichrist and the beast against God's people. If it were not, it would not be referred to as often as it is. And when we first see it, we're told that this is a mark that is going to be given. This is in Revelation chapter 13, that this will be given, it says in verse 16, it causes all, both small and great, both rich and poor, both slave and free, to be marked on the right hand or the forehead, so that no one can buy or sell unless he has that mark, that is, the name of the beast or the number of its name. So when it says it causes all, is that, does that mean absolutely all? It could. When it says both small and great, that seems to suggest people who are obscure, you know, they're not well-to-do, they're typically not seen by many people, they're just sort of workaday people. It could also mean small in terms of little kids. Could mean that too. But here's the thing. The passage that talks about those who receive the mark and who are punished as a result of this, so we see this referred to in Revelation 19 and also Revelation 20, it would not be the case of children who are given that mark if they are below the age of reason. And even children who are above the age of reason but still young, and maybe too young to really know what is going on, or maybe they're coerced into this by their parents, or there's some other coercion. People in that category would not be facing judgment, and they wouldn't be punished, because in the case of younger children below the age of reason, they can't make a decision against God anyway. They don't have the capacity to commit a sin. And the younger you go, the more that's true. And then if somebody is compelled to receive this against their will, then that person, even if it's not a child, it could be adults as well. If somebody's compelled to do something, they have no choice. They're forced into it. Well, they're not committing a sin because it's not something that they would have chosen to do. So if it turns out that this mark is given when the time comes to everybody, including children, those children below the age of reason will certainly not be guilty of doing something wrong, even though they got the mark. You see, James?
Okay, yeah, that was what about parents protecting children? I mean, I know that there's a lot of things we don't know, but that's just something, as a parent, you think about all that type of stuff.
Well, I'd like to think that I would have protected my children if, when I was a young father and my kids were still living at home with me and my wife, I'd like to think that I would have done whatever I had to do, you know, interpose my body between them and any danger if that came to it. But obviously, this is still in the future. So what it means exactly, it's hard to know. I mean, there are a lot of theories that people have. Some people think that it's going to be a microchip. Some people think it will be a tattoo of some sort. Some people think it's the vaccine. Some people are up in arms about that. But we just don't know. And I'm confident it's not the COVID-19 vaccine. I have no qualms whatsoever to say that it's not that. But whatever it winds up being, if parents can do something to shield their children from it, they should do so.
Okay.
What do you think?
Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much for answering my question.
You're welcome.
It was a lot of help.
You're welcome. I appreciate it. Thank you. Let's see. We have a little time before we have to go to a break, so I want to share with you a few other things. The number, by the way, 888-914-9149. I thought this was rather humorous in a not-so-humorous sort of way. The president of America's second-largest teachers union was claiming that critical race theory, or CRT, is not being taught in schools, despite the fact that her own union has spoken out in support of critical race theory being taught to the kids and of the practice and vowed to defend teachers who defy bans on critical race theory. And this is brought to us by the Daily Caller. American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten, she made the comment on Wednesday while she was speaking at the annual AFT Teach Conference. Critical race theory is not taught in elementary schools or in middle schools or in high schools, she said, while adding that, quote unquote, culture warriors are bullying teachers and trying to stop us from teaching accurate history. Well, not only is it well documented that critical race theory is being taught in public schools all over America, many users on the internet were quick to point out that Weingarten's own union has promoted critical race theory in schools. AFT Treasurer and Secretary Frederick Ingram said in a June 14th interview on Good Morning America that critical race theory, quote, allows educators to give our students the opportunity to understand the full breadth and the depth of American society. Critical race theory, as you know, because we've spoken about it from time to time on this program, it holds that America is fundamentally racist and teaches people to view every social interaction and every person in terms of race. Its adherents pursue anti-racism through the end of merit, objective truth, and the adoption of race-based policies. The union also has referred to CRT as, quote, an irreplaceable lens with which we can view our difficult history and a way of understanding how racism has shaped public policy and law. So Weingarten herself, she even declared that her union would defend its members who are punished for violating state laws that ban the teaching of critical race theory. So, you know, you can't have it both ways, madam. When we return, I want to share with you a very helpful, I would say a very important article from Catholic World Report on why critical race theory is contrary to Catholic education. If you've got kids in Catholic school, or if you're just teaching your kids the faith and you realize that they're getting a very different message in the public school that they attend, or maybe seeing it on the internet, TikTok videos, etc., this is something you really need to pay close attention to. I'll share this with you when we return from this quick timeout. Again, it's why critical race theory is contrary to Catholic education. I'll be right back with this and your phone calls right after a quick timeout. Please stay right there. The programming you hear throughout the day on the Relevant Radio Network is sponsored in part by Christendom College. More info at getprinciples.com. We thank them for supporting Relevant Radio.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
I want to share with you an article that just came out in Catholic World Report. Their website is catholicworldreport.com. They're good people, and they produce a good product, so check it out. This is entitled, Why Critical Race Theory is Contrary to Catholic Education, written by Denise Donahue. Now, I'm not going to read all of it to you because it's rather lengthy, but I want to get into some key points that she makes, especially because you as a parent, if you are a parent, or if you're going to be a parent, or if you're a grandparent, or you just care about the kids, which I hope you do. I'm sure you do. These are all things to be aware of, especially if you're on social media and, you know, the far left Catholic Amen Corner. They're out there. They're active on Twitter, the far left, and they're beating the drum in favor of critical race theory. And they might try to shame you into thinking you're a bad person if you oppose critical race theory, or look, this is evidence that you are a racist if you're against critical race theory. This is one of the tools that the far left uses, and especially those far left Catholics who are beating this drum on social media, Twitter, Facebook, etc. Be aware that they're going into these discussions thinking that you don't know anything about them. And I'm not talking about them. I'm talking about critical race theory. So this is why little by little we're trying to spin up to speed so that people can have some information to use when these conversations take place. So back to this article. I'll quote you a few sections here. Today, emotional and heated discussions and protests focus on race seem to fill social media, endless news cycles, and opinion journalism. Concepts including wokeness, intersectionality, and systemic racism may be explicitly advocated or implicitly underlie conversation and classroom teaching. Terms such as racist, hate, intolerance, and oppression belong to these conversations, but they can at times be harmfully wielded as hasty moral judgments and powerful rhetorical weapons. Some parents, including Catholics, are rightly surprised and concerned about false and hostile interpretations of traditional culture, values, and history that have been introduced both overtly and covertly into public and even Catholic schools and colleges. These come in the form of new diversity, equity, and inclusivity programs, approaches, and ideologies. Efforts like the 1619 Project in History, anti-racist quote-unquote science curricula, art classes focusing on decentering of whiteness, claims of white supremacy in health classes, diversity, equity, and inclusivity, the acronym for that is DEI clubs, canceling of classic literature because of racism and bias, and even the banning of some whimsical Dr. Seuss books for perceived insensitivity and racist content seem to leave no class or subject untouched, even mathematics. I have an article I'll share with you at some point about a guy who says that black holes, and I'm talking about like out in space, those black holes, that they're inherently racist. I won't drag that into this conversation. I'll save it for another time. The article says all are seemingly being rewritten to restructure perspectives away from traditionally understood truths in a misguided effort to counter racism and bias against African Americans, other minorities, and others perceived to have been ill-treated by the dominant American culture, past and present. An example of such rewriting and reframing is the 1619's project claim that the American revolutionists fought for independence from Britain in order to protect the institution of slavery. In some cases, teachers are being pressured or even required to attend diversity and sensitivity training to advocate for historical interpretations or political positions that they believe are untrue, and to persuade their students to publicly advocate those positions. Many Catholic colleges and other Catholic schools are scrambling to find resources to address these issues rather than relying on the solid foundation of Catholic moral and social teaching. Some have incorporated secular DEI programs. Now, again, DEI is the acronym that stands for diversity, equity, and inclusivity. To appreciate the dangers introduced by such programs and influences, it is important to understand the forces that have inspired this paradigm shift. Chief among them is critical race theory, or CRT. Critical race theory asserts that America's legal framework is inherently racist, and that race itself, instead of being biologically grounded and natural, is a socially constructed concept that is used by white people to further their economic and political interests at the expense of people of color. It asserts that all non-whites in the United States are victims of racism, even when it is not apparent, and that even supposed legal advances against racism, even those during the 1960s civil rights movement, ultimately, get this, protect a system that benefits whites. So I'm going to interpret that last line for you. Even the 1960s civil rights movement, with freedom riders and Martin Luther King, and, you know, all of the significant and heroic figures of the civil rights movement in the 1960s, not to mention the governmental response to this by codifying laws to prevent and to prohibit the discrimination of people simply because of their race. All of that, they're saying now, that was really just a way for the white people to protect their benefit system. What? The concept of colorblindness, for example, rendered American society insensitive to the more subtle and systemic racism in our society, or so the theory goes. The concept of intersectionality also plays a part in CRT. Intersectionality asserts that no person can adequately be identified in one group, but must be identified as belonging to multiple groups. A woman, for instance, is not only female, but also must be white or African-American. She must be lesbian or straight, Christian or non-Christian, and so forth. It is therefore possible for a person to experience multiple forms of victimhood and oppression, not just racially. While there is jockeying for position for which victimhood status takes priority, when making claims upon others, CRT is predicated on the belief that race is the fundamental pivot point of injustice and oppression in the United States, with whites as the oppressors and the blacks are the oppressed. I want to pause here and offer you a thought experiment. I don't want to make your head explode. It might, but let's take that risk, shall we? Here's a thought experiment. According to critical race theory, white people bad because white supremacy, white people are inherently racist, etc. You hear this all the time now. Are some white people racist? Yeah, certainly some are. No question about it. But so are people in other ethnic groups as well. But according to the current ideology, white people equals bad because racism, white supremacy, etc. Brown people, black people, other people of ethnic minorities whose skin is darker, they are the oppressed minority. Okay, so according to this thesis here, ultimately that trumps everything else. That's more weighty and significant than any other intersection that you might find yourself as or in. So here's my thought experiment. Let's say that a black female athlete loses a championship game or meet in the case of track or something like that. And she loses that to a white trans, quote unquote, woman, biologically a male. So he's already got two strikes against him, biologically a male and white. Is she being oppressed by him because he's a male and he's competing against females because he says that he identifies as a female? Is she being oppressed by that, or is she being oppressed by the color of his skin? I wonder how the CRT people would answer that question. Is there racism being perpetrated? Is there oppression being perpetrated on the part of the white trans athlete who happens to win against the black female athlete because he/she is bigger, stronger, faster, etc.? Does skin color play a role in that? And I have a feeling that that would be answered as yes, that's racism. It has nothing to do in their minds with the fact that it's really a man competing against a woman. So they get themselves all tangled up in knots when questions like this and other ones are asked. So the article continues. Carefully defining terms is a good first step. It's important to be cautious about using terminology pushed by critical race theory proponents, including oppressor, oppressed, marginalization, systems of power, white supremacy and domination, colonial beliefs and deconstruction as common parlance throughout the school or college. These terms, if ill-defined or used disingenuously, which they often are, can be divisive and harmful to the minds and hearts of young people. Their use is encouraged as a means to political ends. Students taught with critical race theory materials can become racist in the literal sense of the word. They may treat others, the perceived oppressor race, unfairly because of skin color. Division into categories of good and bad based on skin color is a reversal of the civil rights movement of 1960, and it's antithetical to a Catholic understanding of human dignity and equality. Catholic education is Christocentric and based on the gospel message of unity and communion, which Jesus taught when he said, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called the children of God. And blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy." Critical race theory harms the unity of all people that Jesus prayed for. He prayed that all of them may be one, Father, just as you are in me and I am in you. That's from John 17. St. Paul taught this in Ephesians 4, saying, "To strive to preserve the unity of the Spirit through the bond of peace, one body and one spirit, as you were also called to the one hope of your call, one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all." Those who push critical race theory call slavery America's original sin in an attempt to co-opt a fundamental Christian dogma. Traditionally, original sin describes the disobedience of our first parents in the Garden of Eden, which marks the whole of human history. It is only the collectivist sin, in the sense that all people are born in the state of original sin, which can be removed through the sacrament of baptism. Catholic educators should ensure that students understand that sins are committed by individuals through their own free will and must be acknowledged and repaired to balance social harmony and communion. According to the Catechism of the Catholic Church, sin is a personal act. That's from paragraph 1868. St. John Paul II, he clarified, saying, "A situation or likewise an institution, a structure, society itself, is not in itself the subject of moral acts, but the collective actions," now this is no longer a quote from him, "but the collective actions or omissions of individuals within certain social groups or even countries are the result of," as Pope John Paul II said, "an accumulation and concentration of many personal sins. This is not to dismiss the incredible harm and evil that accumulated personal sins can affect, or the need for entire societies to challenge injustices and evils at work within their structures." So here he's speaking about how, notwithstanding what people are saying about structural sin, he's pointing out that in a sense there really is no such thing as structural sin. There's only personal sin. And when you have enough of the personal sins that you and I and others commit, and that winds up affecting a whole culture, it's not the structure that's sinful, it's the people within the structure who are sinful. A last little bit of this. She says, Catholic educators should teach that sin, the sin of one person, does not extend to their progeny, their children and grandchildren, since their progeny too will have free will. You ask, why is not the son charged with the guilt of his father? Because the son has done what is right and just and has been careful to observe all my statutes, he shall surely live. That's from Ezekiel chapter 18. Critical race theory improperly attempts to assign the responsibility and burdens for sins committed by others in the past to you today who happen to share a skin color with the sinner in the past. That's a very important insight. You did not own slaves. Maybe somebody way, way back related to you, or maybe even unrelated to you, but the fact that you have the same skin color, according to critical race theory people, indicts you. And yet you yourself were not guilty of that. Now, there's much, much more here. It's a very good article. I encourage you to read it. You can access it by going to relevantradio.com/Patrick. Jim will have it posted for you there on the show Twitter feed. Go to relevantradio.com/Patrick. Share it with your family and friends. I'll be right back with Hour 3 right after this.
I'll be back.